Good afternoon. Thanks, everyone, for coming today. We are in session. The first agenda, our first item on our agenda is approval of the agenda. Are there any changes? That's not a change. All right, the agenda is approved. The next item is the approval of the January 28th, 2020 meeting minutes. Are there any changes, additions to those minutes? Hearing none, the January 28th minutes are approved. The next item on our agenda is the university president's report. President Stokes?
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. I think my provost just probably, he just said to me, are you about to tell them everything I was going to tell them? He said, oops, I guess we should coordinate in advance. So I guess we'll find out, you know, when he has to come second. There's just no telling what's left for him to discuss. It seems like it's been a while since I've been here, so really glad to have a chance. I think my schedule has prevented me from attending a few of the meetings, so glad to be able to be here. You know, I thought I'd just give you a couple of updates about a couple of important things that have been going on, and then I'd be happy to answer your questions or get your thoughts about some of the things that are going on. Probably one of the biggest things that's happened is that we did end our 30-day session of the legislature, and some of you were probably up at the legislature with your projects or for various things. And by and large, I will say that the legislative session turned out to be more positive than we initially thought, because I can tell you there were points when there were threats to cut major money from different parts of the university, and in the end, you know, most of those things were not realized, and in fact, we ended up in a positive place in some areas. Not exactly what I would call the year of higher education, but which is what we've been saying, 2020 should be the year of higher education. But we did make some headway on a couple of very important matters. To me, probably one of the most important matters was the headway we made in finally, for the first time in years, actually being able to explain that when the state says they're giving a 4% raise, that they're only funding us for less than 50% of that. And on the health sciences side, it's really 25% of it. And we, and some of you might remember that last year, we ran into an issue of the state saying we were going to do a 4% raise. And then we had funding through the budget leadership process of only funding 2%. And then we found out the governor had struck some language when she was going through bills that seemed to mandate that we were required to give a 4% raise. And so the BL, the budget leadership team, went back, and they ended up raising tuition some so that we could give a 3% raise. But it was a really difficult situation because we were the only university in that position, but we're the one also most affected by the formula that was being used to fund compensation. So I think the fact that we did that led to a lot more deep dives into exactly how the state actually funds compensation. And so we came out of the session with, we think, a formula that will fund at least 70% of any compensation increase that the state promotes. And so what came out of the Senate there at the last minute was a rise in the compensation level being recommended by the legislature, and that is a 4%. It may be an average of 4%. It may have language by the governor that, again, mandates a 4%. We don't know yet what's going to happen with that. But either way, we will be in a much better position on this issue in that upcoming fiscal year because this compensation formula has changed. So I think all of higher education has benefited from the little political hit that UNM took over the issue of the state funding for compensations. I'm most happy about that. We also got increases in the ING funding. Of course, it's never as much as we want. I think we wanted a good 8% increase in funding through the formula. We ended up with about 2.5% on Central Campus, and in our, we have about $5 million coming through the formula. That's new funding. Branch Campus has got about $570,000. The IMG for the medical school went up 1.5%, so they got an additional $950,000. Of course, all of this is subject to the governor's, you know, decisions about, in some cases, about what to keep in the budget. So some of these things, you know, might not be permanent, but I think much of it will be. I'm not expecting too much to be cut via the governor's veto power this year. We had several priorities for RPSB. Some of them we did well, some of them not as much, but I think several people will be pretty happy with new research RPSBs that were funded by individual legislators and others who didn't really get what they hoped for. By and large, I think the biggest increase probably went to the Cancer Center. Sustainability, they've taken a real hit related to some changes in the way federal funds were, you know, given to them. And so their increase, if it stays the same, is about $2.5 million, which is a pretty substantial increase. Others also got some good increases. And so, you know, unevenness given the various interests of our faculty in some of these projects. But I think in the end we did pretty well in terms of total amount of money. I think the total increase was about $6.7 million, so that's pretty good. We also did pretty well, except one big project we just never could get ground in pushing forward for a new building for fine arts, but we did get GO bonds recommended for academic and research infrastructure, and $30 million for College of Nursing and Population Health, and then our branch campuses have some of that. So that will go to the voters in November, and there will be a marketing campaign on the general obligation bonds for those projects. We also had quite a lot of capital via the severance tax, and so several projects ended up getting some funding via that mechanism. Most of you have probably heard about the Opportunity Scholarship. It was the governor's big initiative. There was lots of discussion with the governor about that. It was initially proposed as a last dollar in. It didn't get funded in the House. Then the Senate ended up putting in some money. It's ended up being something that in this first year will be for the two-year schools. Basically will cover tuition and fees and come in to better serve those that are Pell eligible. So we're looking at the impact of that for us in this next year, something that we have to pay a lot of attention to. Frankly, my concern had been about the last dollar in, that that it wouldn't end up serving the students with the most need. Because last dollar in meant that our Pell eligible students basically would have Pell cover that amount, but they wouldn't have access to additional funds, and the cost of coming to college is really more than the tuition and fees. And so the switch that was made was intended to help remedy that, and I was grateful for the conversations that took place around that. On another note, you might be aware that we have a lot of discussion on campus about what is being called the Gateway Center by the city of Albuquerque. This involves the possibility that, the Gateway Center is intended as an emergency shelter that would be configured in such a way or designed in such a way that different populations of the homeless could come in and receive services that would get them the help they need depending upon their special needs, whether it's women with children or families or single people, people with mental health issues, people who are struggling economically. I mean, if you study the homeless, you realize that it's certainly no homogeneous population. It really is a lot of different groups that are homeless for very different reasons. And so their needs are going to vary. And the purpose of the Gateway Center is to provide, have the services available, but then create and design a structure that separates those populations. At least this is, these are the things that have been explained to me. And there's been lots of discussion about that as the ideal. But, you know, the people that have been working on this have toured other cities and looked at the ways they've been resolving issues related to homeless populations, and so it's one of the ideas that has definitely emerged and is a high priority for the city of Albuquerque, who received $14 million from the taxpayers toward this facility. That's not going to do it. It's going to take a lot more money to do what the city plans. But many of you might be aware that Dr. Paul Roth had been asked to chair a committee for the Chamber of Commerce that recognize that for the city of Albuquerque, success in building industry, et cetera, that they needed to tackle homelessness. And they asked Dr. Roth to chair the committee. So he was among those that visited many cities. And at a time when they were trying to figure out where it could be, a piece of land that is not currently scheduled for use on the master planning, the master plan for the health sciences, which is southwest of the Office of the Medical Investigator, a little southwest too of the Cancer Center, was put up as a possibility. And, you know, quite honestly, my impression was it wasn't really high on the list of places. There were others that I was told were higher priority. But as we got to the vote, it came to my attention that this was a place that the city was really serious about. And I'm sure one reason why, there's more than one reason why they would be interested in that property. One is that it is proximate to services that UNM can provide. And a second reason is that they don't have that much money. I mentioned the $14 million. They will ask for money, capital funds from the county. They'll ask for recurring funds. They were not successful in getting a lot of capital funds from the legislature in this session. And so to the extent that they can acquire land at minimal cost, it allows them to put a lot more money into the facility itself and the services. And so it wasn't until after the vote of the city that it really became clear that there were serious interests in UNM property, which meant that we really needed to vet this with our university community. So the city did some education, had a forum in early in mid December. I think the UNM site was among those that was considered a popular choice, but there was another that was higher. And then we began having forums on our campus. So we had the students led a forum, and then we had three additional forums. And we have a survey that's available until Friday so that people can weigh in on this very important issue. And you can imagine the kinds of divisions in people's thinking about this issue. I've had people ask me if this is a done deal. You know, I know certainly that from the city's perspective, that's what they would that's what they would want. But I feel like it's really critical that we gather the information we need, that we hear from our community about this before I figure out what recommendation to make to the Board of Regents. And so that's where we are. You know, I certainly welcome the input of people in this room on the issue. We certainly are hearing from the neighborhoods around our university as well. So, and it is a complex problem. The thing I know is I do want UNM to be part of the solution. I'd love for our faculty, staff, and students to be part of solving the problem that is a major homelessness problem in Albuquerque. No question that that's what I want. Whether that means we're talking about the use of University of New Mexico property or that particular site is the open question at this point. So happy to, you know, talk to you further about that. big search process going on. We've got lots of dean searches. Provost can talk about those. He's chairing the other big search, though, which is for the executive vice president. We've been holding special traveling office hours forums to find out what people are looking for in Paul Roth's successor. This is a very big hire for the university, one of the major leaders on our campus and in the community and in the state. So one of the decisions that was made that you probably have heard about, those in the HSC certainly have, the decision to separate out the dean of medicine from the executive vice president position, so that a dean of medicine who would then be hired via the process with faculty input by the new executive vice president, the dean can focus on academic matters, the educational mission, the research mission, the clinical mission in medicine, and the EVP can focus on what is really the broad academic mission, plus a tremendous mission of clinical health care. If you look at health science systems across the country, you'll see the extent to which the issue on every campus that has a big medical health system is that there's been a shift so that clinical revenues drive everything. So a huge proportion of what happens in a health system is driven by clinical revenues. And so it leads many people to worry about an imbalance, and I think that's what drove so many people to say how important it was to separate the decision. And that decision has been met with almost unanimous, cheer, basically. So I think it'll be a big change that many people are looking forward to for health sciences. And we'll have people on campus. You'll know about that process that goes on. The provost is chairing that committee. We are using a search firm that's very familiar with these areas. I'm continuing doing my traveling office hours, so, I really like to see people. You're always welcome to come to those. They're typically most Wednesdays from 10:30 to 11:30 someplace. Somewhere. Varies every time. And I just wanted to mention that we had a really great conference on sexual assault. The Department of Navy co-hosted with UNM a regional discussion about sexual assault and sexual violence prevention. And we had like 300 people participate, about 300 online participate. I think this is going to drive a lot of discussion. Of course, it's an arena nationally that is very, it's, I think, talked about around dinner tables, if we eat around dinner tables ever anymore. It gets talked about a lot. So it was really nice to be a part of the national conversation with the Navy, because it's interesting, the academies, the military academies, they have a very different culture than universities do, but we have things to learn from each other about what is really a universal issue on various types of campuses. And so I really appreciate the leadership of many who helped put that together. I'm sure there's lots more I could say, but I'd like to give you a chance to ask me any questions that you might have.
Question on the Gateway Center.
Yes.
Besides using UNM land, how much involvement will UNM have after the fact?
So, I think there is an expectation. We have the expertise to provide a lot of these services. We don't have the funding to do it. And so part of what I know is true is that this is about putting together the funding to hire all the different kinds of workers, of staff, of health professionals that would be required to provide the services there. So that is part of it. I'm hoping that UNM will be part of it, no matter where the Gateway Center ends up being located, or if it's configured to follow a different model of individual smaller units with services in different parts of the city. I just don't know where it's going to land, but I think UNM will have a role in some of those services. We currently do provide some services at the Westside Shelter, but the issue is funding. It's a huge issue, and there's money for behavioral health at the county level, well, you know, I'm not really sure how all this is going to get navigated, but I think UNM's been pretty clear about our limitations without resources, you know, to expand our services. But I know our folks, a lot of them are very anxious to be involved in those providing those services too.
I have a question here.
I have a question about the Opportunity Scholarship. Are you at all concerned that it's being geared to the first 2 years will lower our enrollment as students who either weren't going to go to school or decide, hey, I'm going to go cheaper, will now go to other schools? Not worried at all? Okay. I'm not worried.
No, I didn't say that. Okay. That's not what I said.
It's like what we were.
She's like really worried.
We all along have been looking at the implications of the Opportunity Scholarship for UNM, and it is absolutely true that a decision to fund for 2 year institutions and for 4 year institutions who offer 2 year degrees really does put us in a position of having to look at what the impact will be. We are looking for ways to mitigate that potential impact. And we may come up with something. I think the longer term issue here is for me, and James will speak to this, that he and his group have been looking at this very closely. It really is that they've only provided $12 million. And what I knew when the governor's office called to say, here's the compromise we're trying to broker with regard to the Opportunity Scholarship, a decision to do 2 years the first year and then do 4 years in the second year, the total price tag that they estimated for that was about $49
million. Right.
And
right.
So now that we're at 12, I don't know. Now, the good thing that happened is it looks like they put more funding into the lottery scholarship,
right,
which will benefit UNM enormously.
Absolutely.
So that is a strong positive.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're just going to have to see how this goes in this next year. We have been documenting what we expect to be the fiscal impact. Depending upon what we're able to come out with in this year, we'll see what it means. Our applications are up significantly. But whether the yield,
right, sure.
Yield looks like is a different matter altogether.
Okay, thank you.
So unless someone has a pressing question, I have one last question. And it may be better for the provost, and we're into your time already, but...
I do that to him a lot.
No, but it's not anyone's fault. We needed that input. So the health professions programs and the health sciences centers, about the search, the EVP search,
mm-hmm.
they graduate a significant portion of our students on campus. And so people from, dental, radiological services, occupational therapy, physical therapy, EMS, there's no representation or not enough representation of that group on the search committee. Is that something that we can talk about or address?
I will have to just tell you that it's tough
mm-hmm.
to put together a search committee that represents every constituent group. And so what I think is really critical is that we put together a search committee of 25 people. So it is a large committee. I'm not sure the president's search committee was any larger.
About 26, yeah.
Yeah. And what I think is going to be critical is that there are people in the room on that search committee who understand those programs. And I think that becoming knowledgeable about the needs of all those programs is going to be important. So it's a good balance. I have people from Central Campus and people from the HSC, people from the community, all on the community on the search committee. What you put on committees are people that you believe will listen to the voices of those who are affected and interested, and can bring those issues to the committee as you look at and evaluate the qualifications for someone and the kind of candidates you want to bring. So I will tell you, search committees this large are really difficult to manage, quite honestly, in terms of a process like this. So I've had to, and you have no idea how many other holes in the process, holes that I didn't fill with the search committee too. So I've had to just kind of say, I think this is where we are.
Thank you.
Okay. And thank you for serving.
Okay.
Anybody else?
I just want to second that really quickly, if I may. So perhaps we're not on this committee, again, being one-third of the graduating body of the HSC. That's quite significant. But maybe we could be on the School of Medicine Dean search. Maybe we could be considered for that search. Because that might also affect that population more as well. So I would really like to promote that for the future.
And I, you know, it's fascinating. I was in a situation where I'm putting together a search committee before the decision has been made about whether the dean's position is going to be separated. And, you know, so it got complicated trying to balance what this could look like if, in fact, it was both the dean of medicine and the EVP. So I will definitely make sure people understand. And the thing, the groups that were thrilled about the separation are, in fact, the other schools that I think feel they have a that stronger voice when there is a dean that is not also the EVP.
Okay.
All
right. Thank you. Thank you very much. Provost Holloway.
Thanks. And I think that's really an excellent suggestion. Of course, that's where it's most immediately going to impact those programs is with the dean of medicine. So, of course, President Stokes talked about half of what I was going to talk about, but that's okay. Most important is she got to talk about all the good stuff, all the new money we're getting from the state, and I'll talk about the bad stuff. Let me actually, though, since we were talking about searches, let me start there. Of course, you know we have four dean searches going on. We have candidates on campus this week and next for the education dean search. We have Jeff Fairbrother here today, who's from the College of Education, Health, and Human Sciences at the University of Tennessee, and then another candidate at the end of the week and two more the week after. Next Monday, we'll announce the names of the finalists for the for architecture and planning, and they'll be coming on campus starting about a week after that, and then we'll be rolling into Anderson School of Management and College of Fine Arts. So those are rolling out. President Stokes mentioned the EVP search. The other big search that's coming up folks should be aware of and thinking about is Vice President for Research. And I'm doing some listening now with folks about what do we need to be thinking of for that next Vice President for Research. So that'll be the next major search coming out. And we'll be launching that probably still this term with the expectation that a lot of the work will happen early in the fall term. The goal ideally is to have someone in place by next January. We'll see whether we get there or not. Vice President Lopez has indicated that he's willing to stay on for a few months if we need him to, although he'd also like to really take a sabbatical, so we'll see how we can balance that. So those are the major updates on the searches. With regard to searches, let me also talk about deans and dean evaluations a little bit. As you all know, we do an evaluation of deans through a survey that's sent out under the provenance of the Committee on Governance. I'm told nobody knows what happens to those. I can't tell you what's happened to them in the past, but I can tell you what I'm doing with them. I'm starting to get them now. I review them, I go through them, and then I sit down with the deans and I talk to them about what I see as the common themes in terms of areas of challenge, areas of strength, areas for them to think about. I'm encouraging deans to think about then reflecting to their faculty the ways that they're responding to those. I think these kinds of evaluations are most useful when we go to those who provided us with input and tell them this is what I did in response to your input. And so I'll be doing that as well. So there's an evaluation of me that's done. I asked for that to be done by all faculty, staff, and students. President Stokes has that now, but once I have it, I get to see a redacted version of it. Once I have it, I'm going to, in my academic dispatch, I will talk about what I saw in that and reflect on it. And I do that in part as a model for the deans as well. So I do want you to know that those evaluations of deans are being looked at and used to go back to the deans. Yeah.
Will that also include the branch campus deans?
The branch campus deans, their evaluations are reported to their chancellors. And so I can talk to their chancellors about how they use those, but I'm not I don't evaluate those deans.
And then who reads the chancellors?
The chancellors come to me. Actually,
yeah, they should.
Yeah, they should. I need to check on that, actually. I'm not sure when the chancellors are done. But the chancellors would come to me. And therefore the same process with the chancellors.
Point of information.
I haven't gotten those yet, so that's why I'm pondering. I have
I was really hoping someone from this campus was going to read those. That's all I'm going to say about that.
Okay. Yeah, Provost. The branch chancellors report to me, so those will come to me. They just haven't come to me yet.
Yeah. Just a point of information. Kennedy, do you have any clarification on that process?
For the chancellors. Are you doing the chancellors or are
we
not?
Yes, we've done the chancellors and they're completed.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. I haven't seen them yet. So that's with regard to dean evaluations. Then I was going to talk about some of the legislative actions, but I think the president started to hit the highlights of those. I do want to talk about, now that we have more information about what the state budget is probably going to look like, impact on the ING budget for the main campus units. I talked about this last time. At that time, we were modeling about a $12 million budget cut. With the new information, we're looking at, assuming that everything goes through as planned, the governor signs the House Bill 2, we're looking at about a 3.7 budget reduction. That's about $10.2 million, so less than we had anticipated earlier. That does build in an expectation, expectations is the wrong word. That models a 6% enrollment decrease. Our hope is to do better than that. That is to not have a 6% enrollment decrease. But for reasons I've talked about with this group before, we knew it was really important that we not be overly optimistic. Mm-hmm. What we've done for years is be optimistic and then do mid-year budget rescissions. This fiscal year, I came to this group last fall, and we were talking about a $4 million mid-year budget rescission. We found a way to not do it. Neither the senior vice president for finance nor I like mid-year rescissions. They're disruptive. They're bad for they prevent planning. So we didn't do that $4 million budget rescission in the middle of the year, knowing that we would have to build it into the budget going forward. And so this $10.2 million budget reduction in the ING budget is the $4 million from this year plus about a $6 million going forward. Again, based on a 6% enrollment decrease. We hope not to have that. We hope to do better than that. But the question was asked earlier, what's the impact of the Opportunity Scholarship? In other states where tuition programs have been put in place for two-year schools, the immediate short-term impact has been enrollment decreases in the four-year flagships. Those usually are transients, but that has been the immediate impact as a reduction in the enrollment in the 4 years. We are working on some strategies to try and increase yield, and so as President Stokes said, our applications are up. We're doing some things around optimizing financial aid offers that we hope will increase our yield. We're offering financial aid to groups of students kind of in mid-range SAT, ACTs that we haven't offered support to in the past. It's what State did over the last couple of years that allowed them to see some enrollment increases. So we're moving into that same space and offering some students support that we haven't in the past. So we hope to be able to push against some of that possible transient effect from reducing the cost of two-year schools. And we'll see how that works out. We are doing some other things as well outside the ING budget, or outside of the ING budget development process that we think will be helpful as well. One is that really through a lot of conversations and I think thoughtful work by the UNM Foundation Board, they've increased the payoff from the endowment that will result in about $1.7 million coming into UNM from endowment payout that hasn't been there before. That's not unrestricted money. That's donor money, so it goes into specific purposes, but it goes into student support. Some of it goes into programmatic areas, and so it is additional funding that can help the academic mission. We're also doing something that's a little technical, although we talked about it with this group before. We're taking the benefits pool, which is the pool of money we use to pay people's benefits, and we're moving that pool into the units. The reason we do that is a benefits pool creates money. When there's an empty position, we call that a vacancy savings. There's unspent benefits money. Mm-hmm. Traditionally in this university, that's collected centrally. That's where central reserves came mm-hmm. from, things like that, that we've all spent down. But that savings comes every year when there are vacancies. When you move vacancy pools out into the units, not only does that allow the savings to go directly into the units, it actually allows units to think more critically about their staffing practices. It allows them to think about, how do I optimize my staffing? Do I delay hiring by 2 months for a particular reason? If I do delay hiring, there's actually a financial benefit to doing that. And so it allows units to think more carefully about hiring because they reap the benefits. And so when you distribute a benefits pool, you actually produce more benefit savings. You produce more vacancy savings, and those will be available in the units. So we're trying to do that. We've all agreed we're going to do that. We're trying to do it this year. It's a pretty complicated from a technical standpoint, and so we've got a technical team trying to figure out, can we really do it this year? Although Teresa and I are confident we can. The people who have to do it are kind of like, whoa, wait. Yes?
Are the units the colleges in this case, or departments?
Mm-hmm. So the units are, that's a complicated question, because the size of the unit really matters. And so, for example, in a small unit, in a small, the Honors College, for example, it's such a small unit, it's not clear that it's safe for them to manage a vacancy pool or a benefits pool that's so small, and we might collect it at a higher level. College like Arts and Sciences, it's a very large unit. Size is what matters here, because you need to be able to pay benefits, and so keeping the pool at an optimal size is a part of figuring this out. And so that's part of the technical work to be done. At what level does it best sit? Yeah.
How do I optimize staffing? Do I delay hiring by 2 months for the financial benefit of the unit? I think my question is, if units are optimizing staffing in that way, proving that they can operate with a leaner staff, does it then become difficult to argue to continue filling these lines, or will the university then come back and say, oh, well, you managed to run on a smaller crew, and because you've proven yourself effective, we're going to actually...
It's a great question.
I'm just trying to project the possibility.
It's a great question. So the reality is that many universities have done this. Many have had a central benefits pool and moved it out. Many have had central or distributed benefits pool for a long time. And that's not usually where they go,
okay.
Right? That's been a conversation as part of moving this out. The fact is, you know, we have to deliver on our mission. We're mission-driven. And so when we need to hire a faculty member, when we need to hire a staff member, we're doing it for a reason. And this just gives you some opportunity to say, because that vacant, here's another way to think about it. Even without thinking about, am I going to leave that position empty for 2 months? We do leave positions empty for 2 or 3 months while we're trying to fill them, longer for faculty positions. Currently, those savings don't go to the unit that holds that position. And so simply by putting it out there, you create that opportunity to collect those, independent of kind of decisions you make about when to fill positions. But it is important that right now we have a slightly perverse system in which the salaries are paid by units, and units hire and draw on this benefits pool, which was not increased in size because of the hiring because of that new hire. And so we've got currently a system that's kind of disconnected, and it makes it impossible to actually plan in a careful way around hiring, because no one owns the whole cost of an employee.
Is it possible, when writing the policy, to support this, that there could be some language about protecting lines?
About protecting lines?
Yeah, protecting, like, faculty lines. When you talk about vacancy, faculty lines, mm-hmm. as something that would modify, I just think that... As somebody who's in a unit that's pretty lean, it brings me some concern that we want to make sure that there is no way to get people on, that they don't find them
Certainly we've been talking to the deans about this process. It would make no sense to me to say we're not going to fill a line for that reason. You don't fill a line because you don't have a need for the person. You don't have a need for what they're... You've shrunk or you're moving in a new strategic direction and we get the kind of person. Not because... you're going to save 20% of their salary on benefits. That's not the reason not to do it. The salary is a much bigger reason to kind of make that kind of argument, and we're not in that world now. Okay, so those are kind of the key things I wanted to hit. With respect to the ING budget as a whole, this will be the topic of discussion at the March 9th Regents meeting, at the FNF meeting before that. As part of this as well, I know we talked last time about the tuition recommendations and the tuition recommendations that we're looking at. And again, these are just recommendations at this point. They have to go to the president, they have to go to the regents. But the 2.6% increase in the base tuition, which is the higher education price index, so that's sort of typical across higher ed. And the other big piece is currently, UNM provides students who are taking between 15 and 18 credit hours. We provide a $850 discount for students in that range, and the proposal is to reduce that discount by about $400 as well. The reason for that discount was to encourage students to take a full-time load. It was put in place at a time when we were in a different world. The lottery scholarship already encourages students to take a full-time load, so we don't need exactly the same set of tools. So we're looking at reducing that discount by about $400 as well. Those are the two major tuition proposals. And student governance is proposing an increase in student fees, both in the amount and the structure, that'll take them from bringing in about $600,000 a year in student fees to about $750,000 in round numbers in student fees. So a slight increase in student fees, but also a change in structure from a credit hour-based student fee to a flat $25 per student fee. So that's a proposal.
And then make up some of that here.
And then these adjustments
to tuition and points to the deficit? They're all factored in there. The proposed tuition increase and other things are all factored in to that template. And again, in the end, some of these decisions, they're up to the president, they're up to the regents, and so these are recommendations at this point based on what we currently know. Yep.
I had a question about the lottery scholarship. So I understand there's going to be more funding. Does that mean the percentage that's going to be covered will increase from 60% to some amount?
Yeah.
Because my concern is, again, the equity and inclusion impact. If it means that some students are not going to be able to come to the four-year college, but potentially through the lottery, more will be?
Yeah, and so what's happened with the lottery scholarship is if nothing had changed, then in the fall it would have covered about 65% of our tuition, basically short, not enough people buying lottery. And so what the state is doing is putting $9.7 million into that lottery pool. That will allow the lottery to cover about 80% of our tuition at these proposed rates. And so it will keep the lottery scholarship up at a pretty good level.
It's a great level.
And the criteria for qualifying is still the same?
Has not changed.
This will be our last question.
Congratulations on the distribution of benefits. That's a great idea. I remember vividly the moment it was taken away from us and brought centralized. So I think that, I really feel like I was in the room when that happened or something. I feel that I've been restored in some way. Just a quick question about the foundation. Yeah, were it that simple. The foundation.
Wait, are you Aaron Burr?
No. That's a nice reference, though. I like it. The endowment. So right now, I think it's at a 4.1% distribution. So is that a legal issue? Because I didn't. For years, we've been told you can only take 4.1. Is that going to be done at the unit level? Like, if I have a scholarship tied to an endowment, can I now take 4.5?
No, if all of the endowments will pay out 4.5.
They'll just pay it in general.
And how units spend the distributions is unaffected.
Oh, okay.
So you have a larger distribution.
Yeah.
If you spend at a lower rate, it just accumulates.
Okay, thank you.
I
didn't know you could just do that.
The issue of how it's set is the foundation's bylaws effectively set a range, and then the board every year has the power to set what the payout is.
I'm just curious why we haven't done that before, but that you wouldn't know the answer to that. Yeah, I mean, why haven't we've been suffering a long
time.
And
the reasons are always that foundation boards get careful with this is they're trying to preserve the capital of the endowment and beat inflation.
Like the land grant permanent fund, yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Okay. The next item is our Faculty Senate President's Report. I'll truncate my comments today. First, do I have any comments from the members of operations? Yes.
I just want to remind senators that the invitations for participating in the graduation ceremonies is out. So please sign up. Seeing a good showing from the Senate would be a wonderful thing to see. I know that the students would enjoy it, and the faculty, other faculty members who are regularly there would enjoy it, and certainly the parents and supporters of our students would enjoy it.
Oh, I can just say that the governmental relations competition, where we promoted the speech and hearing sciences project for HIPAA compliance, did get fully funded for about $100,000. So yay to us. Yeah, really. Yeah. Thank you.
And I just had a quick announcement, just an invitation. We're having a press conference on the Complete Count Committee for the 2020 Census. That's a week from tomorrow at 11 a.m. in front of the Student Union Building. We're also having a block party on April 1st, and that's also going to be in front of the Student Union Building from 11 to 2 with food, and people can sign up. But most importantly, if you can distribute that information we shared with you last time to your students, and even dedicate 5 minutes of your class time and encourage your colleagues to do so, to just stress that urgency. And the last reminder is last semester, I mentioned that we were doing a pilot assessment of student learning outcomes for the U.S. and Global Diversity and Inclusion requirement. We are still looking for volunteers. So if you're interested, please email me, nlopez@unm.edu. It's really about building a community of practice, not just compliance only, but a community of practice around equity and inclusion curriculum and pedagogy.
Yes.
Nancy, could you say when and where the events are?
Absolutely. So the press conference is next Wednesday, March 12th. I'm sorry, March 4th. I'm going ahead of myself, March 4th. It's a Wednesday at 11 a.m. It's only an hour, and that will be in front of the Student Union Building. All of the information is posted online on events under race.unm.edu, but also the UNM calendar, and maybe we can send it out to our senators, I don't know if you're interested. But if you want to join our Complete Count Committee, we meet every 2 weeks. Tomorrow's our next meeting at 9 a.m.
My students would go to the party. I know they would do that.
Okay, so the official count day, so you know that the census goes live on March 12th online, but the official count day is April 1st, so there's going to be activities all over the city, all over the country. We're having a block party in front of the sub, and that's from 11 to 2. Yeah, and there'll be food, and there will be computers, tablets, where people can fill out the census. And we need your help. All hands on deck. It ends in July. So if we don't get it right, we live with those numbers for 10 years.
Okay. I'll truncate my comments, try to get us back on schedule. I'm working with the university secretary to put together an interim report from operations and from to the Faculty Senate. We got this idea from one of our council chairs, Fran Wilkinson, who put together a very fine council chair report. We're trying to make sure that we have a robust report at the end of the academic year that's forward-looking, that tells us kind of where we're headed as a Faculty Senate, faculty governance into next fall. And we're going to try to put together an interim report for this body in the coming week or two. At the Regents meeting, I mentioned something that I want to mention in this body, is that I've had an opportunity over the last month or so to meet with different people who are associated with the union, and I can't tell you, I'm so pleased with the kind of rapport we're starting to develop. between faculty governance and union leadership. We've still got a long way to go. There's some bridges to be built, but I'm very enthusiastic about where we're headed. In fact, we have some union or we have some folk who will be coming in to visit with our union reps to give them some training over the next week. Liz, is that correct? Is that
next week?
Next week. I'm sorry. And they've been gracious enough to invite me to participate in that as well. I'm very happy to do that. So I'm very happy about where we're headed with the union business. I think in a conversation I had very recently, you know, we talked about the role of faculty governance. When we have a mature functioning union that will work hand in glove, that we should work together, this body will remain responsible for representing our faculty broadly and really representing the intellectual life of our university, and that there will be a division between responsibilities for those folk who will work hard to make sure that in terms of compensation and conditions of employment, that we get the very best possible situation for all of our faculty members, especially those of us who are those faculty members who, you know, often don't have a voice at the table. But we also, in doing that, have to countenance, I think, the significant concerns by HSC about what this union will mean, what parts of the faculty handbook might change that would have an impact on them, even though they're not included in the collective bargaining agreement. The conversations that I've had with union leadership in the last few weeks make me feel a lot better about that, but not enough to simply set aside the concerns from HSC. We have to stay, you have to be vigilant, and this body has to pay attention to that discourse. It can't just be ops, it just can't just be me. It has to be all of us, whether we're in the bargaining unit or outside of the bargaining unit. We all need to be aware of what's going on there. I have much, much more to say about that, but I'll move on. Our RAC process closed. And I wasn't smart enough to get the final numbers. Any don't have the final numbers on that? Okay. But we had, I do know that we had a lot of applications that came in at the very last minute. In fact, at the very last second, apparently. But the system is much better at handling that influx than it was before. I think we have to thank the university secretary and her team, especially Joby, who's worked so hard to put that process together. I walked through it myself to see how it works, and you know, I think we need like 10 more Jobys on our campus, and we'd be just about fine. So if you will, please pass along to Joby thanks for improving that process for us. I asked the policy committee to help us think through what it means when we as a body are asking for a task force to be, charged to do a bit of, you know, whatever work it is for this body that we need to have done. That policy is already in existence, and we'll flesh that out, and I'll share that out with this body when it's appropriate. In the fall, our ethics committee will receive training on ethics that a lot of folk have wondered why AF&T, you know, the folk there are properly trained to handle ethics cases. We're going to try to do the same thing for our ethics committee. Those are just three or four of our committees that we have a lot more to report out from those committees. In the next 2 weeks, we hope to fill all of our faculty committees for next fall. That's ambitious, but we hope to get that done. And that way, those new members will be able to meet with the old membership before the academic year ends. So that we'll try to have that done. I need your help to make sure that, I shouldn't say like Donald Trump, should I?
Oh, no. Please don't say anything like Donald Trump.
So I want us to continue to have our meetings, to have at least one meeting on North Campus each semester. Last fall, of course, we had that meeting, but it wasn't as well attended as we had hoped. Probably not a good idea to have that meeting like right before Thanksgiving the way that we did. In April, we will have another meeting on North Campus in the Domenici Center. We'll get directions to that. But please, I hope we are just as robust in that meeting as we are today.
And have
as much. I'm sorry.
That's our last meeting.
Yeah, it's our last meeting of the academic year. We meet here again in March. The next thing on our agenda is our consent agenda. It is a long consent agenda, and I'll have Rick scroll that so everyone can read it. Do I have a motion to approve our consent agenda? It's been moved that we... Do I have a second? It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? The consent agenda passes. Our next agenda item, we have a number of programs that will address this body. Please keep your comments, your presentations to 5 minutes if possible. We're close to being on time, and we have a lot of things to get done for the rest of the day. The first group that will present for us is Bob Avery, the chair,
chief.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it says chair.
It says, okay, my bad. Strategic planner, Mayor Jacinta. The Division of Ophthalmology. And Bob, you guys, just want to say thank you for your patience. You guys have been very patient in this process, and we appreciate you coming back. Thank you.
Good. So I'm Martha McGrew. I'm the Executive Vice Dean of the School of Medicine, and I'm Mr. Bob. And I'm actually delighted to be here. And happy Mardi Gras to everybody. It's Mardi Gras.
You're trusted.
So I'm actually representing Dr. Paul Roth and recommending that ophthalmology become a department. As you know, the School of Medicine has 15 clinical departments. This is less than many other medical schools, partly because departments like ophthalmology have actually become their own departments at those schools. And our ophthalmology department has grown over the last 25 years so much that they are now ready to become a department. They've grown out of one clinic. They now added an additional clinic, and they're actually out of that clinic now that they've grown so much for that. And even out of operating space, they've grown so much. It makes sense, actually, for them to become a department. As you know, there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that not only are they clinical, but as they become a department, they can have more research and education. In the state of New Mexico, even though we talk a lot about primary care, there's actually a shortage of every type of physician in New Mexico. And one of the things that becoming a department would allow is a residency program where we could train ophthalmologists. I don't know how many of you have been out and tried to get an appointment with an ophthalmologist, but it takes a little while, and so we need more and more. Although Dr. Avery would be happy to see you tomorrow.
That's
after
we have a budget meeting.
That's right. So over 95% of medical schools actually have their own department of ophthalmology. But in addition to the educational portion, the other thing that it will allow us to do is have a more robust research program in the department. And in a state like New Mexico, where two of the biggest illnesses that lead to blindness are diabetes and hypertension, it makes sense to develop a very robust research program in those areas. And in fact, Bob's predecessor, Dr. Arup Das, has been a leader in that. So I'll step back now. I'll go have a seat, and Dr. Avery can tell you a little bit more about what the details of the department. So thank you, and it's nice to see so many of you I haven't seen in a while.
Thank you, Martha. I'll keep it very short. I think probably this is the take-home slide and sort of the rationale. Just to back up as Martha said, there are 15 clinical departments within the School of Medicine. We are a clinical division in the Department of Surgery, so this would essentially advance us one characterization level up to a full-fledged department. At this point, it doesn't really change any of our educational offerings or anything else that we're doing. So, real quickly, the key drivers sort of for this at this point, I think that are relevant. As Martha said, essentially all medical schools have a department of ophthalmology. When we look at the list of academic ophthalmology groups in the country, there are three divisions left, and everyone else is a department out of a little over 100 institutions. So it's time for us, sort of, in terms of nationally how medical schools view ophthalmology. It's important for us, our particular faculty. We have steadily grown over the years. We have become more and more academic in our mission over the years, and we're really at the point where you sort of need the academic chops of being a department within a school of medicine if we're going to retain our brightest faculty. And frankly, if we're going to recruit good people, all of us have trained places where ophthalmology is its own department. Furthermore, as Martha suggested, Dr. Doss recently stepped down, who was our chair for 14 years, so we'd like to have a national search, get some academic reputation nationally, sort of to lead us to the next level, and that's simply going to be a lot more attractive to attend to the department. Martha mentioned the establishment of training programs, not only a residency in ophthalmology, but a residency in optometry and fellowship training for subspecialists in ophthalmology are all things that we would like to do, all things that will be facilitated pretty significantly by being a freestanding department. In New Mexico, we're about the 50th percentile in terms of per capita eye care providers compared to other states in the U.S., so we have a big need. We feel like the most direct way to establish that need is to train people here. We know that if you do your fellowship, if you do a residency, about 50% of folks will practice it in the state where they actually do the residency. I won't talk too much about expanding clinical activity, but again, if you're an academic department within a medical school, it does make you more attractive to recruit faculty, and particularly some of the highly specialized subspecialties like neuro-ophthalmology, uveitis, and pathology. And finally, as Martha said, we actually have a pretty significant research program right now within ophthalmology. That's one of the things we would like to improve. Within ophthalmology, there are networks and there are programs that you have to be a department in order to qualify for their funding as a sort of a condition of participation. So we think it can only help us sort of, again, in terms of our academic credentials. So those are the main drivers. I would say by far the biggest driver would be for us from a functional standpoint is establishing residency and training programs. I'll leave it at that. I'm happy to answer any questions or any specific. I also want to introduce Mary Jacinta, who stood up here. Mary is sort of coordinated and working out the practicalities and sort of figuring out how to make it work, and so we really appreciate it. Yes.
What is the size of the faculty and the division between research and clinical?
So our faculty, we currently have 11 faculty members. Our hope would be that it's sort of part of recruiting a chair, and in order to establish a residency, we probably need to get closer to about 15. So adding about one FTE over the next 4 years and then apply for residency is the working plan. We have one solely basic scientist. Baruch Das does about 50% clinical and 50% research. And then we have several faculty members who do clinical trials, not basic scientists.
Okay.
What would be the impact on the current and future budget for the new slots?
The budget for whom?
To fill the new slots.
So we're in a little bit of a nice situation. Ophthalmologists traditionally pay for themselves for their clinical revenues. So we feel relatively confident that as we hire more clinical faculty, then we'll be able to cover by far the biggest line item in our budget, by far, 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 is faculty salaries. But on the other hand, that's also almost all of our revenue comes from clinical. We get very little IMG in the hospitals. I think the answer to your question is the plan to grow is only as we are able to generate the funds for ourselves through clinical activity.
For the sake of time, we call the question. Do I have a motion to approve?
I move to approve.
Do I have a second?
Seconded.
It's been motioned and seconded that we approve the new Department of Ophthalmology and Visual Sciences. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Measure carries. Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Next, we have the College of Education. Dean Deborah Riffenberry and Dr. Trafinia Peely.
Hi. Howdy. Okay. Hi. I think I'm doing this wrong. So which one do I have?
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Deborah Riffenberry. I'm the interim dean of the College of Education, and with me is Dr. Trofinia Peel-Eady. She was the chairman of the committee that worked diligently in terms of changing the name of the College of Education. Our first slide, I think, really reflects part of the reason why we want to rename the college, UNM College of Education. We are more than you think. Name change from the College of Education to the College of Education and Human Sciences. So the rationale, approximately 1,700 or 53% of our combined undergraduate and graduate students are enrolled in human sciences programs. Faculty and students from these programs do not believe the current name, College of Education, fully reflects their disciplines. A number of peer institutions, and I will share those with you at the end of the first three slides, have the name Sciences or Human Sciences in their title. And a name that includes Human Sciences would help to ensure improved access to reacher support from more diverse funding sources. So our undergraduate programs, athletic training, community health education, exercise science, family and child studies, with concentrations in early childhood education and development and human development and family relations, nutrition and dietetics, and a human sciences minor in the counselor education program. In the graduate programs, as you can see, the graduate programs outnumber the teacher education programs and special education programs. We have counselor education, counseling, educational linguistics, educational psychology, family and child studies, health education, language literacy and sociocultural studies, nutrition, physical education, sport administration, and exercise science. Only two of these programs do not have doctoral degrees, and that is health education and nutrition. The college has been divided in terms of two distinct groups. Educator preparation. There are five programs in educator preparation. Elementary ed, secondary ed, early childhood ed, physical education, and early childhood education. All the other programs in the College of Education are in non-educator preparation programs. And so the process was over 2 years. It was extensive, inclusive, and thoughtful. It included faculty, staff, students, and community members. Data gathering included surveys of currently enrolled graduate and undergraduate students, faculty and staff forums, and a full faculty vote. The institutional Form C process was followed and approved. And these are representative peer institutions that have the name Science or Human Sciences in their College of Education title: Auburn, Iowa State, Louisiana State, Texas Tech, Oklahoma State, Ohio State, University of Idaho, University of Montana, University of Nebraska-Lincoln, and the University of Tennessee-Knoxville. I think it's important for everyone to realize that the first college at UNM was the College of Education in 1889. It was in Hodgen Hall, and at that time it was called a normal school. I think it's important to recognize that the field of education and human sciences has evolved significantly, and as I said in the first slide, the College of Education, we are more than you think. Thank you.
I should note maybe anecdotally that say Louisiana State, LSU, the dean coming in there insisted that human sciences was put first, because when people truncate the names, they tend to truncate it back to the College of Education. So this is something that, in fact, wouldn't take the job unless they made the switch. This is something that reflects what's happening nationally, and we just are getting in the game with everybody else, it seems to me. Are there any questions? We call the question. Do I have?
John has a question. Same two engineers.
Is this a discussion, or can I ask a question?
You can do it in the discussion, or
I personally don't see the science in the courses that are offered.
So I brought the definition of human sciences.
I've read it.
Okay, well, yeah. I'd like to read it that, again.
That'll be in the discussion.
Okay, sorry.
All right, this is points of information.
Okay.
Any other points of information? Yes.
I have a question. What is the significance of having human instead of education and sciences?
What isn't sciences?
What is the human?
She's going to need to read her definitions. So
yeah, that's a point of information, please.
Oh, all right, so...
I'm sorry? Go ahead, please.
So there's a push in education right now around the whole child, and that means that it's just not the cognitive intellectual aspect of a child, but the social, emotional, physical, biological, and so human sciences along with education reflects the whole notion of the whole child. That's very apparent in the recent lawsuit, the Yazzie Martinez lawsuit, where the emphasis is on the whole child and social and emotional well-being. So it's not just education. The definition of human sciences studies the philosophical, biological, social, and cultural aspects of human life. It aims to expand our understanding of the human world through a broad interdisciplinary approach. And I think that the College of Education and Human Sciences is a broad interdisciplinary approach, which reflects the world of education in the 20th century, the 21st century, 2020.
Okay.
Yes.
The last bullet there on expanding your ability to get money.
Mm-hmm.
Is that STEM?
It's STEM. It's also some of the programs in HESS, exercise science, athletic training. Yes. And so because it's only a College of Education, it's been reported by some of those faculty that it's very challenging for them to get funding from NIH, for example, and some of the other funding agencies.
I would ask then, what if the university isn't STEM?
What if the university is not STEM? STEM is
STEM
science,
has a
technology,
purpose, science, technology, engineering,
and math.
Okay, so just in terms of procedure, because we're out of order. So we can ask points of information, then we'll have a vote to whether or not we want to talk about this. And then we can have a discussion, but we should do that in order. We're kind of doing it a little bit backwards here. Sorry. So, do I have a motion?
So moved.
All right. It's been. Do I have a second? It's been motioned and seconded that we change the name of the College of Education from the College of Education to the College of Education and Human Sciences. Is there any discussion?
I can see what is the difference between human sciences and what would be covered in the college, the other part of the College of Sciences. There are science departments as well. So what science are you going to cover that's not been covered already that required having that in the title? There is the College of Art and Sciences.
There is the College of Arts and Sciences.
Right,
that's correct.
Right. So at this point, we're taking a vote on the measure. We're not deciding. You can vote that you don't want to approve it, right? But we don't have debate in our assembly precisely for that reason. The idea is not that we convince other members to change their vote. So unless there's a discussion of a point of information, right? We'll have the vote. Are there any other points of discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? We'll have a division of the body, so we'll vote on cards, and then we'll report that number back to you. Okay, because I don't have, I don't see a unanimous vote. All right. Okay, but we will report the vote on the card to you.
All right, and may I ask a question?
Of course.
If the vote doesn't pass, will there be reasons given as to why? Will there be further discussion? What would the next steps be?
I think the next step would be you could certainly come back to this body and ask again, and we'll go through that process again. I think that we should allow folk to have their vote, and then we'll take up the next steps once we know what the final vote is. All right. So you all have your card in front of you. You know how you can vote there, and we will report this immediately to you. Okay.
So that means we should stay.
No.
So what you can. What do you mean by immediately?
At the end of the meeting, we collect these cards, and the university secretary will tabulate the vote. And as soon as she has that tabulation, she'll share it with me, and I'll share it with you.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
The next item on our agenda is approval of the new core course UNM Gen Ed Math 1XXX B2744. We have Associate Professor Eric Erhardt from the Department of Mathematics and Statistics. Please.
Thank you. Hi, everyone. I'm here to talk to you about the course that we've been developing. So this goes back about 5 years for me. I'm excited to share this with you. We've shown through an experiment at UNM that you can improve intro statistics by teaching it in an active learning way. And this course is actually being designed to meet the needs of students who don't need a traditional statistics course where they do hypothesis testing for half of the semester, but are consumers of statistics and need to understand the information around them in order to make the best decisions in their lives. So I'll start by saying that our current traditional introduction to statistics is for producers of statistics, those in STEM fields who like biology, psychology, who will be using these statistical methods in their research and in their work. Statistical literacy, on the other hand, which would probably be number math 1330, the traditional math is 1350, those numbers are sort of aligned with other gen ed numbered math courses like trigonometry. And the statistical literacy course is a new course designed for consumers of statistics. The literacy course focuses on reading, interpreting the statistics in everyday media. It critically evaluates these statistics and all the influences on the statistics, such as confounders, assembly, how do you get the information together, randomness, as well as error and bias. The focus is on observational studies and quasi-experiments, both of which involve confounding and assembly more often than randomness and bias, which are more sort of experimental ideas. The literacy course uses ordinary English to distinguish association from causation and to describe and compare percentages and rates and statements, tables, and graphs, right? Literacy. This course uses basic arithmetic to take into account the influence of a confounder and see whether a statistically significant result might become insignificant if you take into account a confounder or remove it from the analysis. And there's some basic principles there. I'll say there's about a 30% overlap in content between the traditional intro statistics course and this literacy course. So it's almost entirely new content, or different content. The students who we would recommend taking these two statistics courses, the traditional stats class, those students majoring in STEM, economics, and psychology, were required to take a statistics course specifically. And those students need a class more focused on rigorous foundation for subsequent courses and for grad school. On the other hand, statistical literacy would be for students in non-quantitative majors, such as that don't require an app class, such as English, history, journalism, political science, art, music, philosophy, classics, language, etc. My guess is probably statistical literacy probably meets the needs of about 60 to 80% of our students, and would better meet their needs than the traditional intro statistics course or another math course, which would meet their gen ed requirement. As part of this course, so I'm here sort of as a spokesperson for the person who's developing the course, Milo Shield, whom we hired as a consultant. He's one of the world leaders on statistical literacy. His website is statlit.org if you want to learn more about him and his work. And he is also very much values evaluation and process improvement. And so there'll be a lot of evaluation, both of the course, the students, and the instruction, and ongoing improvements.
Yeah, call a question, Joe.
Yes. Question on the table is approval of the new course, UNM Gen Ed, Math 1XX B2744. Are there any questions?
How this is going to increase the number of hours required for graduation?
It should not.
It's a core course, so it has to replace something.
That's right. It will be a math requirement.
So to replace an existing core class?
It's not a replacement. It's an additional option.
It's an option.
So among all the courses that someone
could take,
this will be one of those.
Do I have a motion to approve this new course? It's been moved. It's been moved and seconded that we approve the name change, the College of Education. The new core course, UNM Gen Ed Math 1XX B2744. Is there any discussion? Let me clarify what I mean when I ask if there's any discussion. In terms of our points of order, it's at this moment, if you feel as a member of the body that you don't have enough information, you're not ready to make your decision, you could at that point say, I would like to place this on the table. You can enter any motions that you have to amend the whatever is being put forward. I don't want us to get confused with asking questions that are points of information with the discussion before the vote. The idea is that when we come here, you have enough information already that you kind of know how you're going to vote. You get final information here from folk who can answer questions that you might have, simply points of information. It is confusing, and I apologize for that.
I think the question we're asking is more clarification. So it doesn't conflict with anything.
Okay.
It's just right clarification of what the proposal is, and this is before we start voting.
Mm-hmm. I think there was some confusion from people around me.
Okay.
About, like, they didn't feel ready to vote, so.
Right. I mean, we can.
On the last order. I'm sorry for the.
Yeah, not this order. I counted. That's why I said we'll have a division of the body, because I noted some confusion there. That's why we'll do it the way that we did. But in this particular motion, it's been motioned and seconded that we approve this. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? The motion passes. Congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The next item on our agenda is the new is approval of the new course, UNM Gen Ed, GEOG 2XXX. We have the chair, Chris Duval, from Geography, presenting.
All right, so I have nothing to present, but just to discuss the course. The course is about information design, which is, if you've seen any infographics, that's what it's about. This is something the geographers have done for some time in terms of designing maps. And these communication devices are used to tell stories in a wide range of media. And this course is basically about constructing narratives by using visual elements alongside textual elements. And so the students learn how to both construct graphics and graphical devices used in scientific communication in various contexts, so both in technical communication, but principally also in popular media communication. It's written around the gen ed expectations for the communications area, because it's a way to kind of bridge both textual communication and graphic communication in specific contexts that are tied to science.
Okay. Any questions? Do I have a motion? Second? It's been motioned and seconded that we approve the new core course UNM Gen Ed GEOG2XXX. Is there any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? The measure passes. Congratulations. Making progress. The next item on our agenda is the new graduate degree in the Department of Health, Exercise, and Sports Sciences, HESS, Master's in Athletic Training Education. Professor Sarah Nottingham will present for us.
Good afternoon. So athletic trainers are healthcare professionals. We do prevention, diagnosis, treatments, rehabilitation, and emergency care for physically active individuals. UNM has had an undergraduate athletic training program since the 1960s. And in 2015, our national strategic alliance, including our accreditation agency, said that we need to elevate this entry-level degree to the master's level. And the reason for that was to better deliver the didactic curriculum, but most importantly, clinical education and interprofessional education. So our accreditation agency said that all undergraduate programs can no longer accept students after the year fall 2022. So we are at a time where we either need to transition our program to the master's level or retire it. And we think it's very important to continue this program. Our program provides the majority of athletic trainers to the state of New Mexico. Most of these individuals are working in the college, university, and secondary school settings, providing health care to physically active individuals. And it's really important that we be able to continue this pipeline to the state. Just a little bit more about the program. As you can see in the documents, we are proposing a 60-credit master's program. And I understand for many that may seem like a lot, but that is comparable to other healthcare professional programs and our peer athletic training programs that average around 58 credits per master's degree. Just a couple other points is that we have accepted our final undergraduate cohort. They started this past January, just last month. So we are planning to do 1 year of overlap with the undergraduate and graduate programs, and that allows us to run both programs and teach at the undergrads without requiring additional resources. So we're planning on starting the master's program in July 2022. The curriculum is heavily guided and mandated by our accreditation standards, which say what we need to teach. As far as the pipeline for our program and workforce, we have very good outcomes with our undergraduate program. We are a smaller profession of about 55,000 people nationally, so we're not looking at a lot of individuals. So our program is proportionate in size. We have about 10 to 12 students per cohort that we graduate at the undergraduate level, and we will continue to do that at the graduate level. We have above average outcomes as far as board of certification pass rates and also employment data. And then we will continue to recruit these pre-health professional students, which would come into the master's program just like they've been entering the undergraduate program. And then just a last note on workforce is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics projects an increased need for athletic trainers that's 23% over the years 2016 to 2026. So we are looking at a positive outlook for our graduates. And just some last notes on budget and sustainability of the program. We currently have 4 full-time faculty, and those individuals will transfer right into the graduate program, so there's no additional faculty need. Same thing with space. We have some great space and resources that will transfer right into the graduate level. We do anticipate needing some additional resources in order to meet the accreditation standards at the master's level. For example, access to standardized patients and simulations, a robust electronic clinical documentation system, some of those things that are commonplace in healthcare professional programs. We plan to offset that with a tuition differential of approximately $65 per credit. And I say approximately, that's what's in our budget now, but that budget can't go into UNM review until after this is approved within UNM. So we're planning on moving that application forward in the fall. And just a last note on budgets, that we do have some accreditation costs that are currently offset or paid by the College of Education accreditation budget, and they would continue to cover those accreditation fees. So that's kind of a broad overview. I don't know if there's any questions.
Yes.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. It sounds like the undergraduate program is ending.
Yes.
Can you speak to where those students might go? I mean, so we're not going to be getting any more undergrads mm-hmm. in this major. Are they going to go to different schools now for their undergrad?
That's a great question. So the ones that are already admitted into UNM, they're going to be taught out. And so the prospective students that are looking to come to UNM, we are recommending exercise science or a similar undergraduate degree,
okay.
because that has all the prereqs for the program in it, and then it would naturally prepare them for the program.
Thank you.
No, I think pretty much the same question.
Okay.
Just to clarify, your program currently is in the College of Education, correct?
Correct. Yes.
And the cohort that's been accepted as an undergraduate, would they have the opportunity to pursue a graduate degree in this overlap, or they'll graduate out as an undergraduate only and then would have to seek a master's somewhere else?
So they'll still be eligible to sit for the Board of Certification exam because the undergraduate degree is still accredited. Okay. So they do have a choice right now where they could say, actually over 80% of athletic trainers have a master's degree. So they do have a choice to say, okay, if I know I'm going to get a master's degree afterwards, do I want to advance my post-professional education in athletic training, or would I rather go ahead and do this right away and then start working more quickly as an athletic trainer? So they do have that choice. Of the students that I've spoken to and the ones we just admitted, all of them were interested in becoming an athletic trainer as soon as they could.
Okay. So the question on the floor is approval of the new graduate degree in the Department of Health, Exercise, Sports Sciences, HESS, Master's in Athletic Training Education. Do I have a motion to approve that? So moved. Do I have a second?
Second.
A second has been moved and seconded that we approve the new graduate degree, Department of Health, Exercise, Sports Sciences, Master's in Athletic Training Education. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? The ayes have it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. The next item on our agenda is the new graduate degree in the Anderson School of Management, MS in Project Management. Distinguished Professor Stephen Walsh and Manager of Student Services, Florencio Olguin, Anderson School of Management.
Hello. So I'm Florencio, and we're here to introduce the new Master of Science program that we're proposing in project management. And this is in response to employer demand for project managers, project controllers, and other technical positions within organizations. And I'll let Dr. Walsh talk a little bit about the support we've received thus far.
So project management is a growing area. We worked with the engineering school because they had some courses. We developed the MSPM together with them. We have an MOU with Sandia. Our two anchor employers are Sandia and Lanel. We have got funding of now nearly $500,000 to help develop courses and fund other folks. We've also got funded by three or four other organizations. I guess you could say this was an 18-year-old overnight success. We started with one course, and another course, and another course. It's been very well received. We have, maybe 100 letters of support, both from schools, companies, small companies, large companies. We have also got, was able to get some internship preference from Sandia. We also have about an annual $140,000 worth of other funding for interns in this program. Today, we've had them for 19 years now. It's time to make this a program. Project management is moved from a artisan-based learning process to an educational-based learning process. For example, the PMO office at Sandia has a PhD in project management, as does the PMO office at LANL. We have a robust amount of students that want to come in, take the courses. We are kind of putting them in our track for MBA and Project MOT, which is a nationally ranked program. In the project management issue, every single student that we have graduated in the last 6 years has got a job. This will allow us to get more focused, more specialized, more needful, and really respond to the needs of the workplace. We have support letters from, if you're familiar with Project Management Institute, the two organizations here, which take our education as education for their certification process. I think we've done it the right way. We've tried to do it the right way. We've tried to work with everybody we can. Did I do okay, boss?
Awesome.
Any questions?
I was just curious, too, how many credit hours will be in this master program?
It's a 10-course issue with a entrance requirement. You could call it 33, I guess. In other words, they have to have some sort of introduction course. And we have developed the introduction course to the software that are big, like also the healthcare industry is very big in this, and we try to include them as well. And we've placed people at every healthcare facility, major healthcare facility.
Okay. The question is approval of the new graduate degree in the Anderson School of Management, MS in Project Management. Do I have a motion to approve this?
Moved.
So moved. Do I have a second? It's been moved and seconded that we approve the new graduate degree in the Anderson School of Management, MS in Project Management. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Ayes have it. Congratulations.
Thank you.
The next agenda item we're going to move beyond, our presenter isn't here. We're going to move to item 16 on the agenda, which is a discussion item. And I want to preface that discussion very, very briefly. This is regarding the Gateway Center proposal on main campus that the president spoke about earlier today. I was privileged to actually host the three of the forums that she mentioned. And I have to tell you, just as, you know, academics, as colleagues, for those of us who are interested in history and the past, it has been really interesting that at several moments, not the entirety of the discussion, but at several moments, it sounded like we were in discussions about desegregation in America, and we've traveled back in time a half century. And so one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we had is an opportunity to, you know, ask questions, but also to hear about the center and to perhaps counter some of the misinformation that's out there about the center. And again, I remain very neutral about where the center will eventually be housed. But as I've said in other places, I'm not neutral at all about this homeless situation that we have in our community. You know, as a person who has in their own family, you know, homelessness, both chronic homelessness and hidden homelessness. And there are four different types. I had five up right there. There are four different types of homelessness that we need to address. The first type is the one that's most prevalent among our students, which is called hidden homelessness. And that's where someone is couch surfing, looking for temporary shelter, but they have a network of friends or family that allow them to have temporary shelter, but they remain homeless in the main. The second is what we call transitional homeless. This is sometimes a kid that's run away from an abusive family, a domestic situation where there are children involved and a family has to be separated, but that family needs the shelter that a gateway center like this might provide. Most of us tend to conflate homelessness with the last two types, which are episodic homelessness, people who come in and out of homelessness. They get back into society, they work, they get a job, but something happens, drug addiction, perhaps some kind of cognitive issue, and they wind up homeless again. So episodically, they're homeless. And then finally, the chronic homeless. And we somehow have come in our society to conflate the criminality that's associated with homelessness with the chronically homeless. If you look at the statistics, the statistics simply do not support those fears. They just don't. That's the truth of it. And we're living in a moment in our country where the truth about seems often doesn't seem to matter. So again, I'm not concerned so much about where this Gateway Center is located as much as I am we as a faculty having all of the information that we need so that when the time comes for us to weigh in and to talk with our peers, our colleagues about this, that we're well prepared for that. That's why we have a discussion item today, and I'm really happy to welcome Carol Pierce and Deputy Director Lisa Hovall, Housing and Homelessness in the City of Albuquerque. They will give a very brief presentation, and then we'll open the body for questions. Please.
Great. Thank you, President Finney, for the introduction. We really appreciate it. And I just might add to your overview is that some of our most vulnerable people are who we see that are homeless. The young people, 18 to 24, are often LGBTQI because their family may not understand. They're out on the streets. Those are often who may become sex workers or they're doing whatever they need to do to get by. And many Native Americans, the percent of Native Americans in our community that are experiencing homelessness is much higher than when you compare that to other groups. So I just appreciate your introduction. Again, I'm Carol Pierce, the Director of Family and Community Services with the City of Albuquerque, and my colleague, Deputy Hovall. We appreciate the conversations that we've had with UNM. We were delighted to be part of President Stokes' forums over the past few weeks. So when we've been with the city with Mayor Keller now for the last 2 years, and when he came and was elected, one of the key issues in our community was homelessness. And so with our department, we've identified many high-impact strategies to address this in our community. Permanent housing, coordinated outreach, better connection to services, and a better emergency shelter. So, and that's the Gateway Center. So right now we operate, the city operates an emergency shelter that's 20 miles outside of town. It's the former Bernalillo County Jail. We house anywhere from 300 to 450 folks out there. We bus people out there from different points all over our community to get them out there. They can get connected to some services out there, but the distance provides some barriers. And we are not open 24/7. That's a matter of funding. So what this Gateway Center will do, and we thank the voters, many in this room, I'm sure, with the bond issue in November, passed the $14 million general obligation bond. That's the capital for this Gateway Center. The Gateway Center would bring an emergency shelter, which is just one piece of a system that we need to address as a community, more centrally located in our community. We call it a big front door because that's what we're missing right now. We have many great providers we work with, Albuquerque Healthcare for the Homeless, Heading Home, Brothers of the Good Shepherd. We could name them all. And it creates a system, but it's a fragmented system. So if you're a vulnerable person trying to figure it out, housing, food, behavioral health services, it's a little fragmented. This big front door, we want to really welcome people, get them connected to service, provide that emergency shelter. And also, the Gateway Center would serve a very core gap in this community. Right now, our emergency providers, so APD, Albuquerque Fire and Rescue, when there is somebody and the term is down and out, you see the person on the bus stop or laying on a sidewalk or maybe talking in the air to somebody, they're picked up, and right now they will go to an ER, primarily UNM Health Sciences ER, maybe Presbyterian or Loveless, or they will go to jail. They're going to go to jail, they've got to have some infraction. That costs our system, taxpayers, about $14 million a year. We can use that money so much in such a better way. The Gateway Center is the big door to have those folks come to our doors to say, what do you need? Oh, you have an aunt in Grants and you're trying to get the bus ticket to get to Grants. You need to be connected to behavioral health. You need overnight shelter so then we can do an individualized service plan to get you connected. So that's one of the core pieces. The other piece the Gateway Center would do is we call them medical respite beds or recuperative beds. Right now, one of the things you see, and I think especially here around UNM, is if somebody's been treated in the ER, and a lot of homeless individuals, that's where they're dropped off, as I mentioned, because that's one of the only places. It's a warm cup of coffee. It's some friendly people. But where do they go if you've had some medical occurrence? We have very few medical respite beds in our community. And so right now we need a place where people can recuperate, get that individualized service plan, and get back into permanent housing or get the services that they need. So it's one of our high-impact strategies, the Gateway Center. One of our top locations is UNM Land that is across from the State Lab. They're on the frontage road. We've heard quite clearly from many people of the UNM community and neighborhood groups the concern about it'll bring more homelessness to your community. Right now, we know there's a problem. We know you have homeless individuals on your campus. We know you have to lock doors because they're going in and using the bathroom. We know that that causes problems. We do think this will be a key solution because people can have a place where that is their bed, they can keep their belongings, they can get connected to service, and we are never here to say it is the end-all be-all. It will solve homelessness for our community. It won't do that, and that's why I start with it's one of many high-impact strategies. So I want to keep it brief because we do want to have questions, but I think that may provide an overview. Did I leave out anything critical?
Can I ask a yes, clarifying question please. For us just as we get started?
Yes.
Can you tell us, distinguish between a walk-in shelter and a drop-in shelter, and what would the Gateway be?
So the Gateway Center will not be a day shelter or a drop-in center where folks just kind of come to hang out for the day, have a cup of coffee, or get a meal. So the primary users of the Gateway Center will be the folks that are staying there, utilizing it as an emergency shelter. However, as Carol said, the other role of the Gateway Center will be that big front door that's open 24/7, both for individuals who are seeking help on their own, but also for first responders who are trying to help meet the needs of people that they're interacting with. So this will be a place that folks in the community who are experiencing homelessness, who just want help, like what can I do next? How do I get connected to the right resource? Can come to meet with a case manager or a service provider, to do an assessment and triage with that service provider, and then get connected to the appropriate resource. I think one of the concerns we're hearing from the community is that this facility, like there'll just be lots of folks hanging out at and around this facility, like we see, honestly, with other facilities in our community, but that is really not the intent or the way that it will be designed. And we're also fully planning, no matter where the Gateway Center is located, to provide transportation to and from the Gateway Center for folks so that there's not a lot of foot traffic through neighborhoods, because we know that has a lot of impacts and we can just avoid those up front.
And if I could add, one really great example we have in our community that you may not know about is the Albuquerque Opportunity Center. So that is an overnight shelter. It's on Candelaria. And part of the negotiation or the work with the neighborhood is they did not want people coming in and out. You probably drive by Candelaria all the time. You don't know it's there. And it's very similar as we're talking about the Gateway Center. Let's get people in there. Let's get people connected. Let's get it turned around and get them back out where they can get connected to service.
Yes, please.
Okay.
I was just curious if there was going to be an effort to work with and educate UNM police if UNM Police is going to be working with them. I've noticed some interactions between homeless people and UNM Police that I thought were less respectful, and I just want to be sure that there's some kind of education program for them so that they can learn how to best serve people who might be having mental health crises.
Yes. We would, thank you for that question. We would welcome that opportunity. And I think I've been aware, after we've had some meetings with UNM leadership, and the questions of security came out, and I think your safety committee sent a letter to UNM leadership about, no, they don't support it. And there were a lot of concerns about what's happened on your Greek Row and some concerns there. And then we responded to UNM, and we could always make that letter available with about a five-page letter on all the things we will do to collectively work together. Right now, we have a pretty tight system, I would say. If there's an encampment, if there's somebody there, if there's mental health training, there is a way to very respectfully work with folks. I think I understood that UNM security police probably feel a little underfunded or understaffed. But I think what we have said, and I know what we've said, we would work collaboratively with this. We will have 24-hour security as we do now out at the West Side. That's an important piece. There are rules that go along with it. But as it relates to the UNM campus and others, we have current agreements now between APD and other folks we do at the Indian Pueblo Cultural Center. How do our public safety folks work together? How do we do that at the state fair? So I think we have many models that we would welcome the opportunity to work together, get the training so we can be respectful as we move to that.
Yes.
First of all, let me preface that I was at St. Martin's as a staff member in 1987, so none of this comes from a lack of appreciation of the need for this. I have two concerns, but at least questions. We know that, like, at the site, I think, 4th, there is already a fairly large homeless population, that we don't see that same concentration on Lands West. And so in the spirit of taking the services to where the people are already congregating, I'm just wondering why UNM looks better, right? And there are a lot of services that remain downtown, healthcare for homeless and Hope Works and stuff. So that's my first question. And then if you could also just talk briefly about 14 million sounds great, but from a sustainability standpoint, what's the thought about that?
So I'll take the first one, maybe, and Carol take the second one. I do want to say one. So we do see a lot of concentrated homelessness in the kind of the corridor, 2nd, 3rd, 4th, between Lomas and I-40, and there are several major service providers in that area: Healthcare for the Homeless, Hope Works, Noonday, are a few. I think though one of the reasons we see such a high number of folks experiencing homelessness in that location is because Coronado Park, which is at 2nd, where 2nd and 3rd Street come together, just south of I-40, is the pickup point for the West Side Emergency Housing Center. That's the facility that Carol mentioned that's 20 miles outside of town, so we have to provide buses to take folks out there and back every day. So one of the reasons we see a lot of people there is because that's where they can go to get the bus to go to the shelter. So I don't think that in and of itself is a reason to, like, locate a new shelter there. What we like about the UNM site, I mean, of course, there's practical considerations around. We've only got 14 million, to your point, that if we could partner with UNM on this site, then there's not a cost to acquire the land, and we can really spend that 14 million on designing the best building that we can get. And we also feel like the close proximity to the services at the UNM Health Sciences campus is also really important, that a lot of these folks do need the medical and behavioral health care at UNM. And then we also see a lot of potential for partnership with UNM if there's such close proximity around research and scholarship and learning.
I just would add, right now we so appreciate the partnership we have with UNM Health Sciences Center right now, the Medical Reserve Corps, as well as many providers from UNM go out to provide services, episodic urgent care, on Monday nights out at the shelter. We're doing that so folks are not coming in, called by 911 to come back into the ER. So there's all kinds of opportunities, we believe, also for service learning in many of the different departments at UNM to really take a broader view on how we see that. On the money, I'll just briefly answer. $14 million for our capital alone. We currently operate about $5 million operating budget for our West Side facility, so that money, as we move forward with additional money, will be for the operating expense. We did have a $14 million ask into the state legislature. We did not receive that this year, but we aren't really worried about that. What the city prioritized was public safety. And the state legislature, working with all the variety of leaders, was very generous in that regard. We will go back to the state legislature next year. We're very optimistic in the 60-day session and what the economy looks like that we will be getting more funding for the center. We also, we have a very good and important relationship with the county. We think the county's role with the Indigent Fund, UNM's role with the Indigent Fund, This is who we're talking about. We're talking about our most vulnerable citizens. The county has given us resources we provide out at the, I always point out to the West Side. And so we have an ask into them as well with their behavioral tax dollars, how they will really be helping us with this center. Thank you.
So in terms of time, we really have 1 minute left today. I want to remind the body that you are always empowered to introduce business from the floor, which means that anyone could motion to have our operations committee or the faculty senate host a forum for faculty to discuss this issue further if we so wanted to do that, right? I, as the president, can't put motions out there, but other people can. So I just throw that out there as some food for thought. We have time for maybe one more question or a motion or... Yes.
Have you polled people who might benefit from these centers where they'd like to be?
Yes. We did focus groups with people with lived experience. That was people that are both sheltered and unsheltered. Yes, I mean, UNM was one of the sites they believed in. Loveless as well, because of Loveless was kind of known as a health center, the former Loveless Hospital. So, yes, and we've got that report on our website.
And for those folks, close proximity to transportation was the big criteria.
We did make a frequent FAQ, copies for everybody that might answer some further questions. Yes. And we welcome the opportunity to continue a conversation.
And also want to encourage everyone to go out and actually fill out the survey that's available for us all on the president's website. I don't know if we have that link handy, but I believe so. So please fill out that survey. We are adjourned.
We need
to make sure that we collect all our cards today.
Cards.
Very important to get your cards before you leave, please.